Well, thank you everyone for joining the Rosie Zoning Zoom meeting today. Thank you to Walk Up Rosendale and Residents for More Residents for organizing this event. My name is Bashak Alkan. I'm going to be your host today and facilitator for this panel. I am a Rosendale resident. I moved to Rosendale when I returned to Boston about 3 years ago. And what a great choice it has been. Me and my two daughters, you might see us around town, live very close to the square. My home is actually in the study area for squares and streets. And I love the community, the people, having access to all the amenities within walking distance. And I'm really looking forward to discussing the future of our community today with these wonderful panelists. I'm going to ask everyone to introduce themselves. But before we do so, I want to go over a few ground rules and how this panel is organized. We have about an hour and a half. We thought we might just have a conversation organized around three key questions during this panel. And then, as you hear us talking, if you have any questions, we don't really have the chat enabled, but we do have a Q&A option. You can click the Q&A button at the bottom of your screens to submit a question. And when we'll see the questions coming in, and I'll today to the best of my ability, I'll try to incorporate them into the flow of our conversation as we go from topic to topic, so that the questions that you ask on specific aspects of what has been said can get answered right away. But we'll also have a Q&A at the end after the conversation is over. I'm thinking perhaps we'll spend 45 minutes or so in the conversation between the panelists before we open it for questions. And I do want to acknowledge that we have two organizers on the call with us. You see their names on the screen, Ben Bruno and Nate Stell. They'll be monitoring to Q&A, helping us get organized. There they are. Helping us get organized. And Kathleen from the city kindly has also joined in case there are any questions that she might be able to answer for you. But she just informed us she's a little sick. So we'll try not to bug her too much. Abdul Razak is, of course, representing the city on this panel. With that, I would like to ask the panelists to introduce themselves. Please say your name, which organization you represent, how you're connected to this topic, and anything fun that you would like the audience members to know about you. I'm going to go in the order that I see you all on my screen. So let's start with Andrea.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I'm Andrea Harris-Long, and I'm the Director of Land Use for the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, which is the regional planning agency for Greater Boston. We serve the 101 cities and towns that sort of circle the city of Boston. I am a planner by training. In my day job, I oversee our housing, economic development, and land use work. And we work with a lot of our cities and towns on zoning projects, like what we'll be talking about tonight, on a variety of planning projects. I have been in Boston for about 3 years as well, almost 4 years. Before that, I was in Seattle working in regional planning, and before that, in Charleston, South Carolina. So I have a lot of love for planning and zoning and consider myself a big zoning nerd. So looking forward to tonight's conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you for being here today. Enrique?
Hey everyone. First of all, thank you so much for having me here tonight. My name is Enrique Pepin, and I am the Boston City Councilor for District 5, and I have the honor of representing Rosendale. I am the first city councilor from District 5 to be from Rosendale. For me, this topic is very important since I got in. It's probably been the number one issue on my desk, and I take this very serious. So this is why I'm excited to be part of this conversation. But thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Enrique. Next, I see Eric.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for having me. My name is Eric Ouyang. I'm the founder of a Boston-based public benefit company called Percy. We work with advocates as well as municipalities to support their planning and development work with data tools. Most recently, we've worked with the town of Reading on their MBTA 3A multifamily zoning for commuter rail communities. What kind of brought me into the housing work was, after graduating school, I spent time out in San Francisco, where you can really feel the impact of not planning ahead for new housing as the economy and job landscape changed so rapidly. And in that city, you saw and continue to see high housing costs, high rates of homelessness, and really wanted to come back to my home city to make sure we don't face kind of that same downside of not planning ahead for our housing demand and need, especially in light of the boom of the biotech industry. So thanks again for having me.
Great. Thank you so much being here, Eric. Burhan?
Hello, everyone. My name is Burhan. I'm a Cambridge City Councilor, so from just across the river. Mainly here just to share experiences in Cambridge as a city that has been like a few months, a little bit ahead of you guys, has passed a number of zone rezonings over the last 2 or 3 years, and just to talk about those changes and what impacts we've seen in Cambridge and what we haven't seen, and just to bring an example of not just, the theory and practice that everyone else is here is talking about, but also what we see post-implementation, and hopefully providing some of that experience to you all.
Thank you, Burhan. Very glad to have you here. And last but not least, Abdul.
Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Abdul Razak Zachariah. You can call me Abdul. I am a planner on the zoning reform team for the City of Boston's Planning Department, and I am working as the project lead for the draft zoning for the Rosendale Square area. Trying to think of something fun. I grew up in an apartment complex. I grew up in density back home in Connecticut, and that was extremely important for me. I was around a lot of friends and a lot of folks who were of the same age as me, and a lot of adults who could watch over me at times when my mom couldn't. And I think for me, while I think about there's a lot of different neighborhoods, I'm also interested in the ways that we promote the kind of multifamily neighborhoods that I've recognized in some places and that I see are valuable and exist across Boston. So happy to be here and yeah, talk with everyone.
Thank you, Abdul. Thanks, everyone, for also sharing a personal story. I want to also acknowledge that it is 7 p.m. on a weekday family time, and I appreciate it, especially for all of you spending after work time with us today. So we're going to start with a little bit of an overview. I know there might be some audience members who are new to this planning process. So I'm going to ask Abdul, can you get us started by talking a little bit about the Squares and Streets Planning Initiative, what it is, and how why it was created, and how has the planning process taken shape in Rosendale, as we're one of the communities that has gone through it. And where are we in the process today? What has been done? What remains to be done?
Yeah, happy to. So back in February of last year, we started and launched the Squares and Streets initiative specifically in Rosendale. It was part of a larger initiative where there's been an identification of neighborhood centers across the city of Boston where we see already commercial and mixed use activity that are extremely close to public transit access and nodes that we see as vital for how folks can get around the city. And Rosendale Square, as being one of those very vital areas, was identified as a place to start one of our small area plans. The idea being that we focus heavily on what's happening around this commercial core and some of the housing that's near it, and aim to promote more opportunity for housing growth with an attention to multifamily housing opportunity, as well as mixed use housing development and commercial development, to provide more flexibility for what kinds of commercial activities could happen in those areas, as well as how they can grow, not just growing at kind of a horizontal level on the ground floor, but also providing opportunities for them to expand in the ways that make most sense for their business. And just overall, as part of the plan process, identifying ways that the city could provide public investment in things such as transportation, the public realm, and open space that's available for folks, as well as, again, things related to small business supports and housing opportunity. And so the small area plan itself went through a process for about a year. The plan was approved last month by the BPDA board. And in it, it has a series of recommendations that reflect action items for several city departments, including the planning department, as well as identification of certain partners who can support in that from around the neighborhood or in the broader region to largely support this idea of housing growth, mixed use growth, and broader community and economic development. Right now, we're in the implementation stage, and the zoning that has been presented is one of the multiple ways that we're going about implementation. So there's a recommendation within that plan, a chapter called our Land Use and Design Framework. And that was a kind of overall vision of what we could see as land use and future possibilities of not only development, but the ways that growth and change could occur more flexibly within Rossendale Square and the surrounding Main Street areas. And of that was a recommendation to update zoning to better reflect that vision. That vision identified with the kind of continuance and growth of the active uses and activity that is found around the Rossendale Square core near Adams Park, and also considered a lot of the commercial nodes that are going up and down Washington Street, along Belgrade, Cummins Highway, and those areas as other spots where we see businesses, but where we could be attracting and bringing more activity to them, as well as bringing more housing towards them. And so with that came us drafting a zoning map that is meant to represent and allow for that flexibility that could promote those kinds of futures. And in particular, the map is not prescriptive of what specifically should be developed, but more open to the flexibility of how property owners and residents and business owners can go about using that flexibility to their own needs. And so right now, that draft zoning map was released on February 14th, right after the plan was adopted, and is in a public comment period from that period onto March 31st, which will be the last day to provide comment. And then our plan is to bring that forth to the BPDA board in April, I believe April 10th, for that board meeting. And then if approved to petition, then we would bring that to the Boston Zoning Commission in May. But yeah, hopefully that covers a good chunk
No,
of it.
that's super helpful. And I was wondering, can you give us maybe just a high level overview? And I'm hoping one of our co-organizers who are assisting with this session can put the link in the chat of the draft zoning for those who haven't seen it already. Can you give us a sense of from before and after? What are some of the key changes? What are we looking for in terms of height? I know height is something that people talk about when we're talking about development. What are we think? What are some of the benefits of the new zoning? And to what extent does it codify what's already there versus, changing for the future? If you can kind of answer that briefly, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, and I think I'll kind of start from where you just landed on the kind of affirming and codifying what already exists. A significant aspect of needs for zoning reform across the city of Boston is that we have a lot of properties and a lot of land that does not match what is allowed by the current zoning that's in those areas. A good example is that we do rezone sections of Washington Street, and there are many sections of Washington Street that are zoned for two-family, even though they have triple-deckers on them, even though they might have a business that's on them, or they're also mapped across parts of Belgrade Avenue, parts of Cummins Highway as well. And so there are properties that are maybe multifamily or three-family or commercial that otherwise would not be allowed in those areas. And that's important because if those properties wanted to make even minor changes, add one story up, add a unit, add a new business or something like that, they would trigger violations by the Zoning Board of Appeals and would have to go through an appeals process to be able to get a variance or a conditional use permit to move forward. And so it adds this barrier to things that already exist and that are already common. And the purpose of updating zoning for just that idea of affirming is to make it easier for folks who are already there to make the minor changes that they may want that fit within the kind of existing land use or future land uses that they see for their property. From a broader vision perspective, one thing that the zoning does that is different is produce this opportunity for growth at both a height and width scale, and also takes in different measurements of what we think of building massing that's much more appropriate to how we can also improve upon the urban design of new projects that are proposed. And so some regulations that are new within the zoning are building floor plates and building lot coverage that really thinks about the scale that a building takes on a yard, as well as things such as a permeable area of lot regulation, which we have not had in the zoning in Rossendale and many parts of the city. On you should have a percentage of your lot that allows for water drainage, and not be kind of paved in a way where there's no water that can go through, which is significantly important in the areas where we see a lot of stormwater flooding issues, or coastal flooding for other areas, like places like East Boston, for example. And so that's kind of largely what we see from the impact that that zoning has in providing that flexibility. Around that core area, we've proposed what is called the S4 district, and I won't go into like the weeds of all of it, but that's the area with one of the higher levels of density where we've proposed where S4 there can be up to 7-story buildings that are developed, and the S5 district along a few parcels that are up to 145 feet. And that's again to provide that level of flexibility based off of what we see from the site conditions that owners have, the financing that they might have, the interest that they have in future development. It allows that level of flexibility. And we also know realistically, with the range of financing futures, with government futures that are going on, that it will depend on what we actually see as projects there, but it's meant to offer that flexibility. And I think the last pieces we saw, as I mentioned, these kind of commercial nodes all throughout parts of the square on these main streets. And to give them more attention and more flexibility, we wanted to provide a higher level of zoning so that the folks who are there could build wealth and increase the commercial activity in those spots, especially in areas where we heard that there are residents further away from the square who would like to have more amenities that are available to them. That would not preclude them from going to the square, but at least give them some more things that are closer to within even closer walking distance. So hopefully that answered some of you.
That's great. I appreciate that. And Ben just put in the chat the link to the map, zoning map and the guide. And if I might ask Ben or Nate, whoever gets to it first, if you can also put the I want to acknowledge there are a couple of questions that came in. One of the questions asks for where's the simplest place to find the definitions of the, you know, the new zoning categories. If you can also provide that for our participants, I think that'd be really helpful. Thank you in advance for doing that. I want to switch to Enrique. You've seen this planning process from beginning to end. You were there at all the meetings. What have you seen? What is your perspective as both, of course, in your role as a representative, but also as a Rosendale resident?
Yeah. So thank you for that question. I have very much been in the weeds of squares and streets from the very beginning.
Yes.
And I actually live right on Cohasset Street, so right off the square. So I've been really envisioning how might this, you know, impact me as a resident, impact the square, how the square is going to potentially look like in the future. And for me, this has been in a way exciting, because when I was running for office, I always envisioned that if we are going to develop in our neighborhood, it's going to be where it makes sense. And when I say that, I envision the squares. I envision places where the local businesses are, where the local transportations are, where people are already congregating. And it excites me the fact that we are now being more proactive with improving the zoning in the city, because I actually grew up in a triple decker. And I love the stories of triple deckers, because a lot of folks view the triple decker as like the ideal Boston home in Dorchester, in Hyde Park, in JP, and Rozzy. But what people don't know is that they're not legally zoned anymore. And if you actually wanted to build one, you have to go through a lot of hurdles. And for me, now as a city councilor, I see a lot of projects that could have taken place, but they didn't. Or some of them have been approved and they were stalled. And like, to use some examples, I like to think about, I've spoken about this before. You have Joe Portalecki's Ace Hardware Store. His project was approved. He went through the process and everything. However, after some time, because of the prices of materials and everything that went up, he wasn't able to do it. After further conversation with him and his family, they're still very interested in still doing it, but going through that hurdle again is probably going to hurt them even more. So being able to upgrade that zone so that they can just do it as is, I know that they're going to be able to have a much easier process. I'm actually seeing it right now with another developer. I'm not really going to call him a developer. He's a local business owner. He owns Moreno Auto Body on Washington Street. And he's doing right now 4160 Washington Street. And the process that he had to go through for the ZBA and the planning department, it was a lot. It was extensive, and to the point where he's still having conversations and design review with the planning department. But I know that this has cost him an extra, like they say, an arm and a leg, where if the zoning were upgraded, this wouldn't have happened. So what I envision here is a lot of new possibility, but also understanding that residents do have concerns, and valid concerns, because listen, zoning is not sexy. when you talk about zoning, it's so hard to even grasp the idea, because some folks say, oh, you guys are going to allow 5-story buildings. This is all just going to become like a mini downtown. Like, we're zoning, but that's not what it's going to be. So I don't know if I should talk about this here or later, but I hear concerns about, local business displacement. How is the character of the neighborhood going to stick? And that's all types of conversation that I'm having internally with the city, with local leaders about how can we approach this so that everyone's take is taken into consideration as we move forward with this process. But I'll leave it at that. I'm happy to speak more on that later on tonight.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Enrique, because that's what I like to switch to next. And I understand at a high level, the idea of the squares and streets was to kind of get in front of that pattern of displacement, right? We have an affordability crisis, and honestly and sadly, it's not unique to Boston. It's shared across U.S. cities. Many cities have been able to take steps even before we got to them. So I want to bring Andrea and Burhan into this conversation to talk a little bit about what are some of these case studies from other places? What have they done? And specifically when it comes to upzoning, and I want to define the term upzoning, which means you're really allowing more development to occur on a specific parcel than would have been approved with the previous zoning. What is that link between zoning, housing affordability, and anti-displacement? And what can zoning do and not do? What are other tools that we might be able to use? So let's start with Andrea, and then I really want to hear about Burhan's case of what he's been working on with the City of Cambridge.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that, hearing from the previous panelists, I think they outlined really well what zoning is meant to do. It's meant to shape development and kind of think about what do you want the future of your community to look like, and how can zoning be customized to make that vision happen. And so, in a lot of places, like you said, we have not built enough housing and we've created this kind of crunch. We don't have enough housing. We have a supply demand issue. And zoning is part of the problem. A lot of our zoning was created in the 60s and 70s, and it was a little bit more restrictive. It made things like the triple deckers illegal to build. And now we're kind of trying to fix those issues. And in the process, I think that it's really important to remember zoning is not a monolith. It's not something that needs to be a one size fits all. And that's actually what I really love about the Squares and Streets initiative, is really taking a neighborhood level approach. I think that that's the best way to do zoning. I think that the best zoning codes that I've administered, worked on, and created in other places, it's really been a community-driven approach, like you're hearing about tonight, and thinking through the community process of creating that zoning. What kind of housing do you want to see in your communities? What kinds of multifamily and duplexes and triplexes and single-family homes do you want to allow? And giving that flexibility to let that happen, and then putting appropriate guardrails based on what you're hearing from the neighborhood and hearing from, meetings like this and conversations with developers and business owners who will actually be doing the building, and bringing that all together, ideally into a very wonky zoning code that can reflect what that overall vision is. And so I think one of the cool things about zoning right now, it is kind of having a moment. I think we're realizing that zoning needs to be modernized in a lot of places. Boston is not unique in being in this situation. Some of the examples that I kind of shared as we were prepping for this panel was what I had seen whenever I was working in the Seattle region. In Seattle, it's a little different because they're a newer city compared to Boston. They're experiencing a lot of really rapid growth, and they're just now starting to make investments in transit and thinking about how to connect their different neighborhoods and expand their housing options beyond downtown. And some of their lower density neighborhoods are needing to densify to kind of line up with the transit investments that they're making. And I think about the Ballard neighborhood in Seattle as a really good kind of case study and example to compare to some of the Squares and Streets initiatives here.
Can you
In
spell the
Ballard,
name of that neighborhood in case people want to look it up, please?
yeah, it's Ballard, Ballard.
Okay,
It's
cool.
an old fishing kind of village, part of Seattle,
Okay.
that very much developed, probably in the mid like 1900s and was mostly kind of small fishing huts. And then as Seattle grew, development pressures happened and the city took a proactive approach, much like Boston is doing now, to say the zoning is not working, the development that we're having is not working. And we also want people to not just be stuck in their cars, and we want them to be able to get to other parts of the city without needing to drive. We want to build a light rail station and in this area and plan for a transit network that can connect this neighborhood to other parts. And so they did an upzoning in the early 2000s in advance of kind of these transit investments that they were planning for. And at the time, it seemed like very scary and a lot of change, because the neighborhood has historically been a kind of smaller enclave of these old bungalows and old fishing kind of culture and industry. But think about it now, 25 years later, they have seen development, but it's happened gradually over time. And they're now in a really good position to accommodate some population growth that actually is going to benefit from the major transit investment that the city and the region is making. And so I think that that's one particular case study that kind of shows the benefits of using zoning as a tool to both plan for and react to population growth and demand, but then also to do it in a proactive way so that you're thinking about, okay, we also know that we're making investments in this particular neighborhood, and so how can we make the most of those investments and use zoning to shape that? So I think zoning is a really good tool to think about what you want from a values perspective, a kind of visionary perspective, and then use tools like, in the case of housing, inclusionary zoning to make sure that as you're getting new housing development, you're including an affordability component so that you're getting a good mix of different housing at different housing price points. So there are lots of ways that I think zoning can be tweaked, and it is through this process to reflect these different needs that a community has. And then at the end of the day, zoning's a long game, and hopefully, over years, you'll start to achieve those lofty goals of having more housing choices, having more housing production, increasing your supply of affordable housing if you do have an inclusionary policy, some of those other tools. So, that's a little bit of kind of one example. Happy to speak to others if it would be helpful.
That's really helpful to hear, Andrea. And I think the kind of what happens next question is I think on a lot of people's minds. So I appreciate the example from Seattle from that perspective. Burhan, switching to you, I want to hear a little bit about how Cambridge has dealt with similar issues, what kind of policy changes you've implemented in your role as well, and what has been the outcomes of those so far? Oh, you're on mute.
Thank you guys for having me. Happy to share my perspective. Also wanted to be modest that, I don't live in Boston, and so, I'll just be sharing my opinions, but I know,
We will not hold that against you.
yes. Each process is unique. Talk about Cambridge, we're not too far from y'all. And we have taken an approach over the last few years of going citywide and trying to change rules one at a time. To give you guys a sense of how bad of a place we're in and how modest these changes really are, even though they sound pretty scary, we were in a place where about 85% of residential units were non-conforming. What that means is that your average triple decker, honestly, even your average duplex and a lot of single family homes were not conforming. And so what happened is that over time, a triple decker would get old, it would get towards the end of its life where it needs a lot of major work. But because it was actually not zoned for a triple decker, you would have to replace it with a single family home. And in that process, two families would lose their home. This was actually very, very common. Even this year, there's been permits for 29 what we call down conversions. And that is really because, over time, we were losing units because they were not allowed. And this is a small part of why both Cambridge, but also Boston, are not back to the peak populations we were in 1950, right? Over that time, the US population has doubled, but we're still smaller than we were 75 years ago. And, we have to set up our cities in a way that makes sense for growth. Forget all the people moving here, but just the children who are born here, they physically need a space to live. Otherwise, the next generation, they just won't physically have a home they can live in, even if everyone didn't want to move here either. In Cambridge, we've done a number of reforms. Most recently in February, we passed a citywide change that allowed multifamily city, in every neighborhood. But I want to start with an older example that is not what you guys are doing, but just is something touchy, but also to show like how even the most touchy things that, were controversial in Cambridge really are quite modest when implemented. So a number of years ago, we removed all parking requirements for new developments, typically called parking minimums, which is that, if you build a new home, you need to build a parking spot for it. Very popular in lots of places, even in Cambridge, because A, you have some places that are quite far away from the T, where, you're more than 20, 30 minutes from a walk from the next nearest red line station. But, this feeling that, a lot of people do need a car to get around, and so you must require it in our zoning code. That's a concept that, makes sense to some regard, and people were very attached to. But we wanted to remove it all. And that's because once you remove something like a parking minimums, the day after, people can still build the same amount of parking that they could before, but they have flexibility. And it sounds very high level when you talk about that because you're like, oh, like who needs flexibility? It's just a parking spot. But the point of zoning is that there's nothing comes for free, right? So that parking spot in a place with lots of construction costs in Cambridge costs $80,000, $100,000. So you were adding $80,000 or $100,000 of cost to someone who's trying to buy a home, and that's not insignificant, especially if it's something that they might not use. And you think about more suburban parts of Cambridge, and you're like, why would they not own a car? Well, not everyone can drive. Remember, zoning is universal law that applies to everyone, right? Most people might choose to drive, but some people might be disabled in a way that they can't drive or touch a car, right? There might be some people who, maybe like live next door to family and they can't really get around themselves, and so they rely on their family, but they don't need to own a car. And lots of other sorts of lifestyles. And so by having a citywide rule that we just loosened for everyone, we gave flexibility to people to live different sorts of lifestyles. And another example of that was, sometimes you would have two units side by side where they would just decide to share one car, and so the other parking spot was not necessary. By removing the requirements, you also allow them to do something like turn that into a garden or green space. But what I think is really fascinating was that this was like, a hot topic because parking is always a hot topic and getting around, and it
Nice.
matters so much to people. But we really decided to remove all parking minimums citywide. And what's happened in the year since is that of all the projects, the vast majority, all except one, have built the same amount of parking that they did before. Except for one project that was near transit where they could not make it pencil beforehand. And now, after parking minimums removed, they were able to build it. And in fact, what they found is that they decided to build half of as much parking as would be allowed before. But even that 50% of parking is not being utilized because in some places, people just choose not to have a car. In Cambridge, about one third of residents don't own a car, but they were still being forced to pay $80,000 or $100,000 for parking that they were never going to use. And I think that, really about having simple rules that, can be maybe not every project you would like to follow the minimum set of rules, but that's okay because it's just about what's allowed and what's possible. And, like first floor retail, we allow first floor retail in a lot of different spots, but every restaurant you go into is a little bit different, a little bit unique. They decide to do things for their own space. And that's really what I think about these zoning rules, is that this is just the bare minimum of what's allowed. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. And in fact, most things over time are pretty slow. And I'll just end with, even though we've passed both corridor zoning and multifamily zoning in our neighborhoods most recently, we're seeing pretty modest housing growth. I think of zoning as something that takes effect in the scale of decades. And doesn't really change your neighborhood in the scale of years. And I think especially in this moment where not only Cambridge and Boston, but the rest of the state is also rezoning, we will see very modest change all throughout the state rather than, dramatic change overnight or even over the next 5 or 10 years. I think it'll be pretty slow rolling.
Thank you, Burhan. That's really helpful to hear. I want to switch to Eric. Eric, you've there are some, and I want to acknowledge there are some questions in the Q&A that I see, and I'll try to fold in as well. But you've kind of taken a data-driven approach to trying to understand what will happen, because I think one of the questions that people have, as Burhan pointed out, is, okay, let's see that I, support this and or recommend changes, but in some one way or another, it gets approved. What changes when? What can we expect to change? Can you talk a little bit about when you've looked at Rosendale through your lens? What do you see as the potential for change?
Yeah, certainly. And just to kind of add on what the other panelists have mentioned, ultimately zoning is about setting up rules that, the market ultimately makes decisions around. So as a property owner, you're making a decision whether or not to take advantage of something that's now available in zoning to say add a unit or build an ADU or perhaps choose to sell a developer your property so that you can make the right choice for you as your needs change throughout your life. And so a lot of the projections that we're doing are really kind of based off of data that we've seen that, Burhan had mentioned as well. After zoning, changes tend to happen incrementally over time. And what we've kind of used as a base point is basically, 10% of lots that seem like they are now eligible for redevelopment to be redeveloped over a 10, 15-year period. And looking at data across Massachusetts, that's fairly consistent as well. But of course, any type of zoning change ultimately is also dependent on economic factors. And, right now we're in a particularly challenging time for projects to pencil. And that really just means that a project makes sense financially for somebody to take on and for them to be able to, pay their staff and the architects and the lawyers and the banks to finance it. And so in our current high interest rate environment, financing a project can be very challenging. And so that's why we've seen that slowdown of projects, certainly post-pandemic. What we've done in partnership with a number of community groups in Rosendale was look at the zoning code as it had existed, as it exists today, applying some of the new districts that Abdul and his team have worked on. And we had come up with what we'd call kind of a minimum scenario and an abundance scenario. And so, kind of in the most conservative set of changes, we saw, maybe 300 units. So very small, very modest. In a more abundant scenario, up to 1500. And that was kind of looking at applying some of those S2, S3 districts. Now looking at the draft zoning that their team has put out, what we've seen is actually taking a middle ground. We're kind of estimating over the next 10 years, less than 1,000 housing units. So of course, if you look at the broader context, 1,000 units may sound like a lot, but relative to existing population growth in Rosendale, between 2010 and 2020, the population grew about 2% or so. And so if we add, just as an example, about say 800 units, if we assume each unit brings in about two residents or so, that's less than 2,000 extra residents in Rosendale, and that's about 6%. Just as a comparison point, in that same period from 2010 to 2020, Boston as an overall population grew about 13%. And so that's about half of the growth that the city saw overall. So again, a fairly modest change over a long period of time is kind of what we're expecting to see based off of the zoning that's being post.
Thank you so much, Eric. And I truly appreciate you bringing those data points to our discussion. I would love for you to put the link to your really cool mapping app that you developed for Lawsondale for people to look around. But I want to get to, with those numbers, let's think about those units, 300 or 1,000 units, get to this question of, well, will those units be affordable to me? There are folks who live here today, and I'm seeing also in the Q&A, who want to stay here, who are maybe renting and they want to settle down here, right? They love Rosendale, they want to stay here. Or they have jobs nearby and they want to be able to keep affording the rent as rents keep on climbing higher. What are some, is zoning really the only answer here? Are there other things that could be done to prevent displacement of residents who are already here and want to stay, as well as welcome more residents to our community to make sure that we can share all the amenities that we have with folks who choose to live here? So I want to perhaps switch to Abdul Razak. Could you tell us a little bit of what other things are in the pipeline with the city? And Enrique, I know you've been involved with some of those efforts as well.
Yeah, I'm happy to start off, and Councillor Pepin can add as well. So one of the major projects that's been going on with the city is the creation of the Anti-Displacement Action Plan, and I can drop in the chat here a link to that as well for
Super.
to
That's great.
reference. So this is work that's been done by the Planning Advisory Council, which is an entity within the city that coordinates across departments, including the Planning Department, Office of Housing, and Office of Economic Opportunity and Inclusion, to name a few. And the primary tools that they've been working on, first, they've released an initial sentiment analysis of the concerns that people have expressed throughout different planning initiatives and processes in the past several years about displacement risk, not just displacement in terms of direct displacement of you might consider things like evictions, but also indirect displacement, like the increase of costs in the general area or kind of more broadly that for both residential and commercial tenants. They also released a toolkit of what exists within the city that has already been kind of rolled out across the several years in response to existing displacement risk. And I think we've maybe spoken about this already, but the status quo of things is already producing displacement at a really high level. And so the city has been doing a lot of work to protect and support residents by way of legal services, financial services, in some instances, support in the acquisition of properties and preservation of some properties. And a lot of that has been provided in that toolkit that's available on the website for folks to see. And the next stage of that is the release of the full Anti-Displacement Action Plan, which would also lay out not only the kind of future onlooking work that the city is trying to do, but some gap analysis of spaces that we can continue doing work in that's in service of the variety of residents and commercial tenants who we see in the city. I would say overall, there's also things that are kind of beyond that plan or that have already been released and shared. Some may know that the mayor had the announcement of a fund for the preservation of affordable housing, and that is a very significant thing to have and is also a representation of our partnerships beyond just resources from the city government or state government, but also pulling in partners like foundations in the hospital system and other sources there. And so that's another mechanism that's available. And while I can't speak on behalf of like the broader community, of community development corporations that are across the city, those are extremely powerful partners in both identifying and connecting with residents who are in already existing affordable housing or who are interested in our owners in producing affordable housing and connecting with them. And so from a more kind of the standpoint of what individual actors, owners who are in this room and who are on this call can do is also if you are someone who wants to support this work of preventing displacement or providing opportunities of affordable space, there's also kind of these avenues of resources with the city and with partners like that to speak with to think about those things.
Yeah,
Thank
just
you.
to add on to Abdul, in addition to financing resources, just to bring a few other examples that we've seen in other municipalities. New York, for example, has a program that will provide as of right tax abatement. So basically, this is a discount on the property taxes paid by a property owner with the condition of building affordable housing. And so it's just another lever that's outside of zoning, but certainly very much closely tied to zoning that can be a resource for building affordable housing and making some of those financing conversations work when, costs are so high today.
Thank you, Eric. That's really helpful to hear what other communities are doing as well. Enrique, do you have anything to add to that?
I do, because that is something that I very much prioritize whenever I'm having these conversations. Displacement concerns of both residents and tenants of small businesses. Starting with tenants, I think that we can really approach this in different ways. Where in the council, one, I actually filed a hearing order to talk more about the anti-displacement strategy that Abdul just brought up, to make sure that there is a combination of both residential and small business focus. I also know that there's a major priority right now for properties that are mixed income housing. I just had a great meeting for another project in Rosendale where he's very much dedicating 20% affordable of the entire units for different types of income. And then, not to mention, we are also being very, we're trying to come up with new ideas in the city council, where I'm working with my colleague from East Boston, Gabriella Coletta, to think about a good landlord tax exemption. So let's say a landlord hasn't increased this tenant's rent for the past few years. They haven't increased it for more, I don't, I'm just going to use an example, for more than 2% of the rent. All right, you are exempt from paying so and so amount of taxes. So kind of creating a good relationship with landlords in our city so that they're not incentivized to increase the rent. When it comes to small businesses, which is funny because that's the one I've actually been hearing about the most personally, landlords, I encourage landlords to really have a good relationship with their tenants. And what's good about Rosendale Square specifically is that it's easy to know who the landlord is. We know that Anthony owns the building at the square root. We know that we know who owns 4198 Washington Street. We know who's about to own Bene Brest building. So it's something unique to our square where I think they also understand the meaning of the small businesses in our corridor. And we have to ensure that this isn't just a conversation between the planning department and the zoning department or the office of housing, et cetera. We have to loop in the office of the small businesses as well. So that I'm going to use an example. 115 Belgrade Ave. We all know this as the Tali Auto Body Shop.
Right.
We were able to get ahead of this because obviously the tenant reached out to us saying, "Hey, I'm concerned about this proposed project in our neighborhood." Mind you, this is before squares and streets is implemented. So it's who knows what could have happened. I think it would have been better afterwards. The landlord never reached out to them until they reached out to us. So we were able to connect them to the small business department, and they actually came up with a good plan and an agreement with the landlord where if the project on 115 Belgrade Ave gets approved, he will give them a whole year to be able to stay there and also work with his lawyer to find a new location to relocate, if he wants to. So there's different options there, but obviously my biggest priority at the moment is to make sure that nobody gets displaced, or if it comes to that, that there is an actual plan in place and that the tenants aren't left out in the dark. Because I think that we have to be very considerate of the fact that the local businesses, our local residents that exist at the moment are what makes Rosno beautiful. So we have to put them at the forefront of this topic. But there are ways to do this. And I'm excited that we're finally approaching this in a more proactive way, where for many years in my different roles as director of neighborhood services, as a former liaison many years ago, I would see where developer would just do a one-off project at this parcel, take the tenants, wouldn't take them into consideration, and there wouldn't be any plan for them. Where I feel like this is a great opportunity to actually have a plan and be more proactive with it.
I appreciate that so much because so much about what I love about Rosendale Square is the diversity of businesses we have. And I know that we are a neighborhood of many communities and many cultures, and the businesses support everyone and where we come together, right? We all come together in the square. And that cultural displacement, I think, is a concern. If building uses change, if new buildings come on board and perhaps they're not as affordable, how do we begin to preserve those is I think a question that people have in their minds. I was wondering if Andrea or Burhan from their experiences had any kind of thoughts on that issue of displacement. And then Burhan, I see your hand as well. Did you want to go first, Burhan?
Sure, I'll go.
Yes, thank you.
I think that, change is scary and hard, and there's legitimate trade-offs. And so it's, easy to talk about, what are the downsides of what we're doing and potential drawbacks that we have to manage in other ways. I just wanted to start off by saying, the current status quo is pretty bad, right? Like, we are losing people every single day right
100%.
now. It's becoming more and more expensive. I think our metro is rivaled only by New York and San Francisco as like second or third most expensive metro in the entire country. And I would argue potentially the entire world. Like, few places are more expensive than we are here. Like, something is pretty wrong and pretty bad. And there's a huge cost of doing nothing. And so, there's something that we're trying to change here, and it's not perfect, and there's trade-offs that we'll need to balance in many ways. But just wanted to start off by like, we're in a pretty bad place, and so definitely need to be pushing for change. I also saw a question just talking about like low-income residents in general, and I would say that there's two like there's different types of displacement that it's helpful to understand, right? Like the first is like you have a low-income residents, maybe that's older, that's what we call naturally affordable. And I think that that's the place where there's the most trade-offs. And so I'll start with that and try to get to the other places then to start with the most difficult of the topic. I think there are a lot of older buildings that end being cheaper because they're the older building. And so, like, more expensive, higher income rents going to the newer buildings. I would say, there's a few different things here. First is that, at least what we're seeing in Cambridge is when those buildings are still getting redeveloped. It's just that what happens is that instead of doing it in a way that adds new units, they often do like a gut rehab, and then you see that same old building, which looks the same on the outside, but on the inside becomes fully renovated and selling for $1 million. So that's still happening to some extent. And then the second is that, we have to think about like why it's cheaper, right? Is it really that like it's the fact that it's inherently an older building? Or is it that there's a spectrum of people who are trying to live in this community? And within that spectrum, people with higher incomes are opting for the nicer buildings. But in fact, if you took all the buildings and allowed them to naturally upgrade and become nicer, that you would still have that same spectrum of people trying to live here, but everyone could have nicer homes. I think that's like a little part of what we're seeing in Cambridge, right? Like Cambridge actually has a very robust low-income population, even though it's not something we think about, because both, we end up creating all sorts of different opportunities for people. Like I had, a mother who kind of came to me who's, was married, and then her husband over time kind of became slowly abusive to the point where she really wanted to move and leave out. And what was happening was that she was able to find one of those like newer micro units, which are not as particularly popular, but like really gave her an opportunity to move out and create a life for herself, and in a way that really made sense. Now you'll still have some amount of displacement in that if you have a building that's being redeveloped, inherently the people who are living there while it's being redeveloped will need to move. And I think that in terms of like that specific case, the work that the mayor is doing, Mayor Wu, around tenant displacement and offering incentives and relocation, like I think really, really make a lot of sense. In Cambridge, what we did is that under the new affordable units that are created under the inclusionary program, we give preference to people who are low income and displaced from Cambridge due to redevelopment. So, in fact, it's not necessarily a net negative because they still have to move, which is a disruptive pattern, but they go from a place where they might be getting low rent because a landlord is being nice to them in a way that's not guaranteed going to the future, to now getting priority to an inclusionary unit, which will be forever affordable and they will never get displaced out of. And so, in fact, there's, ways that, creating new housing and creating, things of like new value can provide really great benefits to people of all income ranges. So those are, it's a complicated topic. There's a lot of different scenarios, but try to talk about like one specific example in a lot of details about how this can be a win-win strategy because there's like so much, value being created that there's enough that we can incentivize to share around.
That's really helpful to hear. Andrea,
I
did you have
can,
anything to add? Yeah.
yeah, I can just sort of jump on. I think something that Burhan mentioned at the beginning of his remarks that I think is important to remember that if we don't make any changes to the zoning and take no action, then that also doesn't solve our affordability crisis. And we're so deep into this crisis, like Burhan mentioned, things have gotten
Decades.
so bad that we have to start taking steps, but the problem is so large that these steps are not going to immediately fix it. There is no one silver bullet for solving our affordability crisis or totally preventing displacement from happening because we have sort of fallen so far behind in meeting the housing production goals and just housing needs that we needed to be meeting. And so I think it's important to not let the fear of this not fixing it quite as much as we would like to hold us back from doing anything. And to remember that zoning, like any policy, can be tweaked in the future. And so, you make one step forward and maybe you realize, oh, we should have really done something different. You can change it. And that's the nice thing about policy and zoning more generally. The other thing that I'll add that I think we've sort of talked about, but I think is really unique to the Boston area and Massachusetts, is that there is such a strong community of mission-driven developers here. And I think that that's
True.
something that I've really enjoyed coming to Massachusetts and getting to know all of the various community-centered developers and seeing the ways that our cities and towns across the region develop partnerships with these affordable housing developers. And so that whenever an upzoning like squares and streets or in other communities is happening, the city or town or the Affordable Housing Trust or the Community Preservation Committee, they can actually, kind of go and talk to those affordable housing developers and say, hey, we just did this change to our zoning and we want more affordable housing. We like how you develop in communities. Let's work together to develop the types of new housing and commercial spaces and sites that we want to see. And so I think that that's another opportunity to make sure that we're creating community-centered new developments that get us some of these other issues of affordability and mitigating displacement.
I think that point of just advocating as community members, advocating for our community and seeing those opportunities and making those connections are so important. And I know, Enrique, you're aware of one development like that is happening, Bank of America, hopefully, fingers crossed. That's going to be a terrific project. Do you know anything more about that? Could you tell us a little bit of a give us an overview and how the zoning change applies to that project too?
Absolutely. So what's happening down the street from my house is a senior housing, all affordable project by B'nai B'rith, where they actually have a current project right now in Hyde Park over at 1201 River Street, where you can see that this is a 55 plus friendly community where it's a mixed income from all the way down from 30% all the way up to 100% AMI. And annual medium income. That's why AMI stands for. I know I probably use too many acronyms in my day-to-day
I
basis.
appreciate you clarifying that. Thank you.
But what's beautiful about this is that I know that's been there's been some concerns about if they're going to preserve the commercial space. They are going to preserve the commercial space because I know that there's a lot of support for the beautiful thrift shop that we have there, where a local residents work there. So the spokesperson for B'nai B'rith has done a good job of realizing that they have to preserve that commercial space in the bottom while also producing affordability in the top. So that's what you're going to see in Rossi Square coming down the pipeline soon. And I think that's going to be one of the first examples. Once Squares and Streets hopefully is approved, they're going to be able to follow the guidelines there and it'll be a much quicker process. And what happens there is that because of the process being quicker, it's going to be more affordable for that organization to be able to build that housing. So potentially even the making the rent even more affordable. That's the beauty about this, is that when we think about the affordability, quicker the process, the probably the more affordable it can be. Because what I've learned is that the more you delay a process, and there could be other reasons, but if it's because of bureaucracy inside of government, I'm not talking about community process. I'm not talking about understanding what the design is going to be. I'm talking about your straight fact, your permits, the things that you have to go through. If that's delayed, that makes the project more expensive. So that's what I'm looking forward to having down the street from me.
And something you touched on, I'm wondering, Abdul, if you can kind of jump in. I think one of the things that everyone needs to be aware of is that none of these projects that are either recommended or none of the developments that, say, a particular landowner wants to do on their parcel, are done without public input, right? There are processes in place to make sure people can advocate for the outcomes that they want in developments in their community as well as changes in the public realm.
Yeah, that's correct. I think one of the major things is that our process of when someone has to go to the Zoning Board of Appeals or when someone has to go through our development review process, those remain the same. And it's really just taking more seriously and holding the hammer on how we treat those triggers and how we respond to them. So, in instances where the people have more flexibility, where they have a really small scale redevelopment, that likely isn't something if they follow the zoning that they need to go through a zoning board of appeal process. But that doesn't preclude neighbors and other folks to say to their Office of Neighborhood Service Liaison that we have at the city, hey, I'd like to still maybe connect with this person who's doing this project. It removes a requirement and, to Councilor Pepin's point, a financial burden of having to go through the zoning board of appeals, but it doesn't stop people from talking with each other, which I think is like another major point of how the communities function. But from the larger scale projects that we call the Article 80 projects that go through development review, these are projects that have 15 or more units or they're 20,000 square feet or larger. Those have to go through a project where a project proponent is submitting an application. That application is public, or the project that they want to propose is public as well. They have to have a community meeting. There's a public comment period, and that has to be approved by the BPDA board before it moves forward. And that's even if they follow all of the zoning rules. If it's at that scale, they still have to go through that because we understand the kind of general impact of projects that are at that scale. And so those allow for still mechanisms for folks to share their opinion, but also doesn't kind of overburden someone who's doing something very small, that overall that flexibility would be beneficial for them and allow for a lot more affordability in their process.
Burhan, I saw your hand, so I want to give you an opportunity to comment.
Yeah, thank you for all that. There's just two brief points I wanted to add, which is that, not everything is replacing something that already exists either. In that, a big part of what we all like, what also we see in Cambridge, once we changed our rules, especially for more neighborhood residential, is like, the thing of like adding a bedroom. You have a new member of the family, you don't want to move, but you want to add a bedroom. That was not allowed under old zoning rules, right? The state has allowed ADUs, but that specific zoning doesn't touch Boston. And, I think not the main topic of what we're talking about today, but like ADUs are a natural and like low cost way of adding housing. And also, I think that obviously what we lose is something that's very touchy because it exists and it's heartfelt and it's changed. But also, it's worthwhile to think about all the new opportunities we create, right? Like you think about the next generation of chefs who want to create a restaurant, right? How like that new space can be so helpful to them, how we think about all the climate regulations that matter to us, and how like new buildings and new restaurants will be mostly electric, right? And that's really great for the environment in that way, but also requires you can use a different set of tools and cooking techniques and all those sorts of things. It really helps in ways that make it cheaper, right? New housing might be more expensive because it's new construction, but I think from this summer or this winter, we all know about how expensive our Eversource bills can be. And without that gas cost, it ends up being that much cheaper. And I think especially in our region, as like natural gas is so expensive and has all these geopolitical ramifications, having an all electric building where we can create some of that electricity ourselves is like, all these other small little benefits of allowing marginal development all across our community that I think that I just wanted to highlight.
No, that's really helpful. And I think, I know many of our neighbors really do care about sustainability, and the squares and streets, I think, enables the kind of flexibility that will allow more of that to happen. I see a couple of questions in the chat, and I also wanted to just recognize Kathleen, behind the scenes answering the questions. We have about five questions that are open in the Q&A. Nine of them are answered, which the rest of you all can see. I want to see if we could begin to kind of go back to that idea of affordability and to affordability for businesses in specific and tie that to parking. I think one of the issues in our community that we're struggling with a little bit is to have achieve that balance in the village, Rosenau Square transit, right? The commuter rail is right there. There is a million buses that go by. Is that people? A lot of people do utilize the parking spaces for the businesses, and I want to kind of get a clarification on what the zoning allows or does not allow for parking for Rosendale Square, Abdul Razak. If I know you're typing an answer to one of the questions, but if you're able to touch on that a little bit, how was that balance achieved, and how What outcomes did you hear in the plan that was then implemented in the zoning ordinance and how it was applied?
Yeah, so I think the first part kind of respective to parking as it's related there, and if I missed anything, let me
That's
know.
good. Sorry, that was a long-winded question. I
Yeah.
think we're all kind of like winding down at 8 p.m.
No worries. Yeah. So within the squares and streets districts, there's no parking minimum that is in the districts themselves.
Okay.
But what we've seen, so one thing, and I think it's helpful to clarify in all the spaces I am, there's a lot of folks who think that Rosendale is the first place where we're doing squares and streets with the zoning, and it's not. Mattapan has had squares and streets zoning for a year, and we've started to see a small turnout. So I think what Burhan is mentioning, Eric, as well, a small turnout of some projects that are within squares and streets districts. And it's been interesting to see that of two projects that I've seen that are at that Article 80 scale, that one that's larger projects, they've both proposed parking without the city asking them to as part of their project. Projects. And so that is really a thing that's responsive to the market in those particular areas where those developers, those proponents saw that in their situation, parking was something that they could afford, that they were interested in offering, but it wasn't a requirement, which for some instances where there might be someone who's a smaller scale redeveloper or they don't see that the tenants that they would have will be in need of that parking. It might be someone who's just building for themselves and a couple other people in their family. That requirement being there can be a burden. And so not having that requirement in certain instances is extremely helpful. And I think overall, using Mattapan as an example that we're continuing to track, we can continue to see what is showing up in terms of real parking need versus kind of an imagined sense of parking need.
Thank you. That is so helpful. Enrique?
No, I'm just so glad that Abdul brought up Mattapan, which is the other another neighborhood that I
Yeah.
represent in my district. And it's cool because about a few months ago, I was able to work with one of the neighborhood associations of the neighborhood, and they were worried about a proposed project going up in Mattapan. But what was interesting to see that is that the proposed project did not conform with the squares and streets layout, and it was very easy for the planning department to be like, nope, scratch that. You got to make sure you work with the community to real to see what is going to fit in this layout. So there is for any community members that are maybe concerned about, or developers say, no, we want to go bigger than what is actually allowed. Like, no, there's actual protections here. And the Mattapan residents actually really appreciated that. And they were able to have a sense of expectations of what they were able to see in the near future. So I just wanted to share that because I'm very glad that Abdul brought that up about Mattapan.
That's really helpful. I see a couple of questions in the chat that I'm going to try to kind of rephrase and pose. So there's a question about parcel sizes. I know that we are a older community. A lot of the parcels, especially around the square right now, are smaller, like that flower shop that recently was up for sale and not really prone to bigger developments, right? So there's a question, might people now that we are rezoned be assembling parcels to do bigger development. Have you seen that happen in other places in the other communities? And what kind of protections? I know one of the things that I appreciate about squares and zoning is that kind of form-based component. What kind of protections does the new zoning provide so that those maybe bigger footprint buildings really begin to abide by the neighborhood character?
Yeah, so an aspect of the zoning that is really important, and it does depend on the kind of scale of those parcels, is it has these building floor plate and building lot coverage measurements. So it's to say that a certain percentage is what's allowed at maximum that someone can build out on a lot. And that also is included with the fact that we have setback measurements. We have front yard, rear yard, and side yard. And we actually have larger rear yards and side yards when they're abutting a residential zoning district. So for folks who are right next to a property that's on Washington Street, you would have a much larger setback for your property to that one if it got redeveloped compared to if you were also in a squares and streets district. So that's really important because it then kind of right sizes the scale to be something that allows for that flexibility if someone were to build that full scale project, but also still provides enough space from abutters in that way. We also do have an aspect where with that building lot coverage and that building floor plate coverage, if someone was had a really large parcel and they maxed out on that, there are some of the larger districts, the S3 and higher, that allow for multiple buildings on a lot. And so they could kind of break up the buildings rather than having one large one and break it up into multiple if their parcel is large enough to do that. We included that because it actually further encourages a better urban design in some instances rather than a kind of full-on block that might be developed, but rather thinking about the space that could be put in between, while allowing for the level of growth that is permitted there, but still providing some flexibility on space.
That's really helpful. Eric, I know you've looked at the parcels fairly closely when you were doing your mapping. Anything to add to what Abdul was mentioning in terms of parcel size and what were the assumptions you made in the projections you made in terms of what could get developed where?
Yeah, no, definitely. As Abdul mentioned, there's a lot of guardrails that have been set up in the zoning to kind of disincentivize or prevent excessively out of scale projects that don't meet the neighborhood form factors. I think one thing that I wanted to add, which I think we haven't talked about as much, is kind of the second order and third order benefits as well of redevelopment. One of the things that often goes perhaps under the table a little bit is kind of the impact on government revenue when parcels get redeveloped. And so we had done kind of analysis of a number of projects recently in Rosendale Square and really analyzing what happened before versus now, just as one example, 20 Taft Hill Terrace. Back in 2017, it was assessed at about $1 million in taxable value. That brought about 11,000 annually for public use. After the redevelopment, it's now assessed at $10 million, bringing in 10x in public revenue at about $113,000 a year. And that those resources can now be channeled into a number of really great programs, including some that the city run for supporting small and local businesses as they think about setting things up, perhaps subsidizing rent or supporting advertising needs. And so one of the things that I think is really critical as you kind of think about redevelopment in an area is how might, say, those increased public revenues allow the public sector to support small businesses, subsidize affordable housing, and perhaps even make generational investments such as an extension of the Orange Line to Rosendale Square and beyond. And you really need those financial resources to make something transformative like that happen. And keeping, say, for example, a surface parking lot, a surface parking lot just doesn't generate the types of financing that you need to make something like that happen. To answer your second question about some of the assumptions, when we were doing the analysis, what we basically had made an assumption around is projects that are only incrementally adding density are probably not a good candidate for ground up redevelopment. So you can imagine if you have something 3 stories today, now you're upzoning it up to four, just as an example. You maybe want to add that additional floor on top if it's structurally sound. Otherwise, you're probably not going to tear it down just to add a little bit more. So our assumption kind of assumes that somebody would only redevelop if it's more than 2.5 times in terms of floor area. We're also looking at building age as well. So something that was built in the last 10 years, probably still a suitable, usable building. It's really kind of the older ones that make sense for perhaps building something different. And I mentioned earlier, one of the main assumptions that we're making is kind of that 2% a year development rate as well.
That's so helpful to hear. Burhan, you have your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Yes, very quick point, but this is like so poignant actually in Cambridge. I just wanted to chime in, which is, I think that the tax levy limit has been a hot topic of conversation, really all across the state and always is. In Cambridge, I think ours is roughly like, 30, 70, where it's like, 30% of our, maybe 40% of our taxes are paid by residential and the rest by commercial. And that's required by the state, right? Like that ratio is like the maximum ratio, so you can't shift more onto commercial. And really, residents do see tax increases year on year. But what's important to understand is that, like, let's say you have like a a billion-dollar budget, that 30% of that 300 million is split among all the residences, all residential, right? So if you have, 300,000 people, it'd be about $1,000 a person. But if you had 600,000 people, you would still, by having that same ratio, you could have it be, $500 a person. And as you have more people, some of your services scale, so it might be a little bit higher than that 500. But the point being actually that the ratios that are required under our tax law actually make it such that, by having new residents, you can actually split the residential tax rate, the total amount of revenue you have to raise from residential, among more people, and so everyone pays less taxes. On top of the fact that new growth in general is excluded from, the annual limit increases. And so there's I think especially in Cambridge, as we've seen the financial situation get tougher, and we went from a place where people, we had very moderate property taxes, but now we're getting concerned about having to raise them over time. Like, this has been a key tool in our tool belt to try to keep property taxes low.
I so appreciate that because that's not something that, as a layperson that I have really kind of thought through the link between zoning to tax and then back to affordability, right? Some of the secondary impacts. I want to switch a little bit. We have about 13 minutes remaining, and I encourage anyone who still has questions that are in their mind unanswered. We only have one that is in the Q&A that has not been answered to date. I encourage you to ask any additional questions you might have. We want to talk a little bit about unit types. When we talk about housing, you mentioned, Eric, that your projections show somewhere around 300,000. Of course, whether that materializes will depend on what owners choose to do, the market, a whole series of factors. But one of the things that we hear in our kind of community discussion is the types of units that are included, because people think that a lot of new units that come on board are going to be studios, 1 to 2 bedrooms. And, if I'm a family, I mean, I have 2 kids. At some point right now, they're kind of squeezed into 2 bedrooms, but at some point, they're going to want to have their own bedrooms. Like, how can I stay in the community if supply is not as readily available? Do you have any thoughts on how, this kind of whole paradigm shifts that, the increase in supply?
Was that directed to me? I missed
Yes,
the
absolutely.
beginning.
Please jump in.
Sure, I can jump in. This is something that we think about a lot at MEPC. One of the things that our agency does is looks at sort of how our households changing over time. We do household projections as part of our transportation planning work. And so we actually are seeing, probably not surprising, that the number of households growing is smaller households. But the issue that we're running into in our region that ties to the housing issues that we've been talking about tonight is that because housing is so unaffordable, there's not a life cycle shift that is happening. So we have a lot of larger household or housing units, homes, 3-bedroom homes that exist, but folks are getting older. They can't really downsize because they can't afford or find that right downsizing option. And so that I think is making this crunch feel a little bit more apparent because, younger families can't find those 3-bedroom homes because the folks who have them that maybe needed them 30 years ago can't find that smaller unit that's affordable. And so it's kind of like it's a complex question because the answer is not necessarily, well, we need all of these new units to be 2 or 3 bedrooms because that's going to work against this overall population growth trend that we're seeing where we're having more single person households, we're having more, maybe 2-person households, and they don't need that much space either. And so it's really about continuing to build a lot of different unit types with different sizes, and then also thinking about how can we help folks who are ready to sort of move through different life stages and move through the different houses that you need at different life stages. How are we facilitating that? And so we see this a lot, especially in our suburban communities that we work in the MAPC region, where a lot of the housing stock are single family homes. We, are talking to people out in the community, and it's maybe a 70-year-old widow who is like, I really don't want to take care of this 3-bedroom house anymore. I would love to not have to try to like get my son to come over and mow my yard, but I also can't afford anything to downsize in my community because my community may not have
Yeah.
apartments or may not allow apartments because the zoning is too restrictive. Maybe there is some senior affordable housing, but it's not enough to accommodate all of the seniors that need it in their community. And so it's a little bit more complex than dictating on a development by development basis. And zoning certainly is not the best tool to dictate that unit count and unit mix, unless you are thinking about like an inclusionary policy where you can make some of those restrictions. But across the board, it's not too good to get too specific in the spirit of what we've been talking about tonight of being flexible and allowing developments to sort of respond to what communities need and the market is kind of driving as far as a demand perspective.
That's really helpful to hear. Enrique, have your hand.
I think that Andrea said that perfectly. I literally see that happen in my inbox in my community meetings a lot, where in Hyde Park, another neighborhood that I represent, you have the Pride, which is a
Right.
senior living a project that had lines out the door with folks, literally out the door with folks trying to apply to live there. You have another one at 1201 River Street. Obviously, we just mentioned the B'nai B'rith building that is going to
That's
be
right.
more senior housing in Rosendale. So what you do see is in my district of District 5, Rosie, Hyde Park, Mattapan, it is the more quote unquote suburban part of the city. And I think Andrea hit the nail on the head where you see an older couple that may want to. You had the kids, no more kids. They want to downsize. And then that house opens up to a younger family, per se. Let's say that's a situation. But what I also see, and it's something that I've been speaking with the Boston Housing Authority, is those units are also being clogged up by families that have had their child move out, but they're still living in a three bedroom, two bedroom unit. And they're not, there's no segue for them to transition to a smaller unit. And then in that situation is even deeper because we're talking about families that are in shelters who could then be put into a Boston Housing Authority unit. And then that family's in the Boston Housing Authority unit to a more different unit. So it's all a cycle. It's a domino effect that I think Andrea just you said that so perfectly that to know the answer, I don't think there is an answer there, but it's just of helping families shift to a area to a new house that best accommodates their needs at that moment. But yeah, just wanted to say that.
Those are very helpful examples. And it's interesting also, Andrea, to your point, to think about how these things, work regionally too. I know we're in Rosendale, we're looking at our community squares and streets that circle that the study area, but whatever happens outside us affects us and vice versa. So that's really helpful to know that your organization has that broader view and brings that clarity to the policy.
Just one thing just to add on,
Please.
Councillor Pepin did a great job illustrating that chain of moves effect where, creating senior housing frees up single family homes for people to move in. And there's a lot of really great academic literature to seeing that for every new unit being created, it's multiple chains of moves that get filtered through the housing inventory that really allows people to get the housing that they need. One other effect that I wanted to mention, which again, it's kind of a second order effect, but when you create studios and you create one bedrooms for people who are, say, young professionals looking to move to the city, that actually does have an impact on making the larger three, four family bedrooms more affordable and accessible because if those units did not exist, you can imagine that three or four working professionals could come together and rent one of those. And certainly, this is happens all the time in San Francisco, where the housing stock hasn't changed that much over the last few decades. And you can imagine that they would very easily be able to outcompete on a market for those units versus a family where they're raising multiple kids and looking to access those units. And so, indirectly, when you're creating units to serve the people who are better suited for studios and one bedrooms, you're actually also creating inventory and availability for the families that need those three bedrooms and more available.
Thank you, Eric. I think this is a really good note to land on, making more housing affordable to more people. And I appreciate every one of you who spent the last an hour and a half with us, our panelists, as well as all the attendees and all the thoughtful questions that were asked. I hope we were able to answer your questions adequately. I want to emphasize for those of you who have any additional questions, the city does have other meetings. I'm going to pull that up right now for Abdul Razak to go over. Let's see if I can, if I'm successful in sharing my screen here. Give me one moment. All right. And I'm going to see if I can make this presentation mode. Can all of you see the slide?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. Could you briefly go over what our audience members can expect in terms of public input opportunities in the zoning?
Yes, yeah. So as you can see, we've had a few public meetings so far in this process since the release of the zoning. Our next meeting is next Tuesday, where we're having a check-in at about the 30-day-ish mark around the public comment period to share what we've heard so far, as well as some potential updates we're considering based off of both what we've heard and then kind of continuing analysis of the area to try to be consistent across how we map the districts in different parts of Rosendale Square. And then the
Okay.
comment period is open until the 31st, as I mentioned. So it'll end in about 2.5 weeks from now. And then we'll have a closeout public meeting on April 8th. So about a week after we finish, where we'll share the updated version of the zoning map that will be brought to the BPDA board and the Boston Zoning Commission. So folks can submit with the links. And I believe there's also stuff that been dropped into the chat for folks there. And I also recommend if anyone's part of other community groups that would be interested in having a conversation, please feel free to reach out to me at my email or General Squares and Streets email. I've had a chance to talk with neighborhood associations. Also was invited to talk at this as an example of folks taking up that offer. So happy to continue doing that throughout the process.
Thank you so much. Well, it is about 8:30, and I have to respect everyone's time. As Abdul mentioned, his email address is at the bottom for specific questions about squares and streets. And I want to again thank all the panelists for making time for us and for sharing their passion, excitement, and insights with Rosendale residents. Thank you.